ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Tammy Shipley believed someone was out to hurt her.
I thought someone was after me and I wanted to just be safe.
She's put under 24-hour surveillance.
I tried to get in contact multiple times.
I'm taking my phone call. Nobody knows where I am.
And then something strange happens.
She just drank and drank and had something like 20 litres of pure water.
Ambulance emergency.
I've got a woman unconscious.
Tammy's story. Search Background Briefing on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Budget announcements, it turns out, aren't always the final word. The pressure is on the government over its contentious tax changes, and we're all waiting to see how much ground the government might give. And on another front, there also appears to be some movement this week. I'm talking about the long-debated Inland Rail project. Now, Inland Rail was originally set to connect Melbourne all the way to Brisbane, but just ahead of the budget, the government announced the project would only run as far north as Parkes in central New South Wales. The line was being cut short, the government said, due to an enormous cost blowout. It was going to cost more than $45 billion to complete. In truth, there were always doubts about how to connect this thing through to Brisbane and what it might cost. Well, for some years, a private consortium had been working on a proposal to instead build an extension of Inland Rail from Gundawindi, which is on the New South Wales-Queensland border, up to Gladstone instead of Brisbane. Now, this consortium is putting a new plan on the table, which could still see the line built from Parkes all the way up to Gladstone with private funding. Is it a viable idea? Well, the Prime Minister held a meeting this week with the main proponent, a man by the name of Everil Compton, who is himself known as the father of Inland Rail. Everil Compton has been pursuing the dream of Inland Rail and lobbying governments for 30 years on the issue. And in fact, his lobbying efforts on other projects and issues goes back much, much further. The 94-year-old has met and dealt with every Prime Minister since Robert Menzies. Not sure anyone else in the country can make that claim. So I'm keen to catch up with Everil to find out whether this Inland Rail dream is going to be realised. I'm David Spears on Ngunnawal Country at Parliament House in Canberra. Welcome to Insiders on Background. Everil, great to catch up with you, and I will get your thoughts on who have been the best prime ministers of the many, many you've dealt with. It is a remarkable history you have, but let's start with this project that you've been so closely associated with for the last 30 years or so, Inland Rail. Where is it at? What did you discuss with the prime minister, and what sort of indications did Anthony Albanese give you this week?
We discussed the project and the reasons why the government declined to provide funding for the railway beyond Parkes. It actually hasn't yet been completed between Melbourne and Parkes, but they
that's due what, end of next year. Is that the time frame to get to Parkes at the moment?
No one's too sure when the time frame is, but so long as it gets there by 2030, that will you know, suit me. But above Parkes, they're not providing any funding now. I can understand that the Prime Minister had to decide to cut the funding on what has been an outrageously costly exercise that should never have cost the money that it has. It was feather-bedded with staff, contractors that weren't necessary, legal action against landowners that wasn't necessary. Everything that could have gone wrong with this project gone wrong with it. So I can understand why the Prime Minister said we've got to cut the bleeding. But I said to him I was disappointed he didn't have a more positive approach as to, you know, what could happen next. And he was willing to listen. And I pointed out that for the last 5 years, I've been working with a great team of people on planning a railway line from the port of Gladstone, which is the best deep water port in Eastern Australia, to have Gladstone connected to the national rail system just south of Gundawindi, the old system. And I've been working on that for 5 years now, and I pointed out to the Prime Minister we've got a long way and it's viable based on shipping containers coming into Gladstone in considerable volumes. And when he decided to stop at Parkes, it meant that our project was dead, because he'll build a railway from Gladstone to Gundawindi that doesn't link up with Inland Rail in the efficiency that it should. And so the project was dead. And he understood that. And I said, I believe that my consortium can extend the thing from Gladstone-Gundawindi to Gladstone-Gundawindi parks that I believe we can get the funding that's needed. Baron Joey, the investment bankers, are my advisors, and provided governments give us surety by giving us unrestricted prime permanent mandate to do the job, we can do it. Now, he was happy to listen, and he asked me all sorts of questions, and in the end, he said to the Transport Minister, Catherine King, who was in the room and who was being very supportive of what the Prime Minister said, he asked her to get her team together in her department and start negotiating with me to get to the point where it could be taken over by private capital. And I was very happy with that. We just shook hands on the fact that negotiations had begun. The Prime Minister couldn't say to me, you know, April, the job's yours. That would have looked like a job for the boys thing. We've got to go through all the legal process that happened. But this thing is on, and in my view, now unstoppable. And so they've done some works between Parkes and Gundawindi, which will have to be valued, and the Australian Rail Track Corporation gets shares for the work they've done. But we can finish this, and we can have Gladstone, we can have Gundawindi hooked up by 2030 and building at the same time from Gladstone. The whole thing should be open by 2032 and come in under budget and on time.
Interesting. All right, just to pick up a couple of things you said there. Who are the private backers? You mentioned Baron Joey, the financial advisors here, but who's paying for this ultimately?
Well, the money will be raised eventually when we get to financial close from superannuation funds, private investors, infrastructure funds around the world.
And that appetite's there, you reckon? They're keen?
Well, we've done our sampling of them, and the main reason why donors don't come out right now and say we are definitely putting money in is that investors in infrastructure don't trust governments. Now, governments of all colours and in the state and federal parliaments for years have on many occasions encouraged private investors to start infrastructure, and then partway through it, the government will change and the next mob don't want it to happen and things happen. Investors don't trust governments. They'll only do that if we get a prime mandate that governments cannot back out of. The governments are not just saying, this is a nice idea. They're saying, you've got authority to build it, and unless you break laws, we're going to let you build it. And so investors know they won't
understand.
Have money.
So that prime mandate, would that have to go to a tender that you would have to be contesting?
Well, technically it could, but I don't think it will, because I have proved for 30 years that I'm just not a fly-by-night guy who came through the door to dream this up. There's no one else out there who's done that long. And I can tell you that I've been looking for investors all over the place for 30 years, and I know where they are, but none of them will come in without surety of this. I'll have no... Anybody else who wants to get involved in this, you can tell them on this program, Dave, to line up at my office, and provided they're legitimate people, they're in. There's no such thing as me having
Fair
a majority.
Enough.
We're talking about $15 billion.
So, sorry, $15 billion. Well, I was going to ask you, what's the estimated cost, or is it too early to be able to estimate, getting from Parkes up to Gundawindi and then to Gladstone? What sort of dollars?
Well, we think it's an extra... It's $5 billion to get to Gundawindi and another $10 billion to get to Gladstone. Now, cost depends on how much inflation Donald Trump causes around the world in the meantime that we're at. A whole range of factors that until I can have the right to examine all the books of account of what's been done now and what's happening, it gets to us. But right now, we're saying $15 billion, that should do it. And we will work a lean, mean operation. We're not going to employ expensive consultants. We're going to employ bright young Australians who are half my age, who've got the enthusiasm and the youthful experience to bring this thing in under budget and on time, the way in which we won't be bleeding the country to death in any way in the course of doing it.
Well, I don't know whether too many people younger than you have the enthusiasm you do, Everald, but in terms of getting a return on that, you're confident that investors who are willing to stump up the money would get a return, and how would that work? Would it be, I mean, we're talking about what, shipping containers coming in or out of Gladstone, going on to this inland rail, and the private consortium or the private investors being able to recoup their investment through that?
Well, look, basically, most infrastructure investors hope they'll get a 15% return on their capital, earnings on their capital every year once the thing is up and running, because you've got to wait while the thing's built and whatever. So wherever we can, building the railway and bits, we'll have trains running regionally with freight long before we've finished the whole thing, so that people start getting a return. But investors come in knowing that they've got to wait for their return, but they also know that once it's up and running and that return is there, their shares then become very valuable and they'll get some capital gain from that if they ever bail out. But I've got no doubt that we can get the money. And in terms of freight, right now the shipping companies of the world want to bring the biggest freighters they can, those massive ones, to Australia. There's only two ports in Eastern Australia who can handle those big freighters. One's Gladstone and the other Sydney. But you don't go into Sydney Harbour and drop thousands of crates. Logistically, the land operation in Sydney City can't handle it, but they can handle it at Gladstone. And so the shipping companies of the world, we've been in touch with them in principle, we've got to sign them up yet, they're very keen to send a big boat to Gladstone, drop all the freight there and go back to the world while it gets distributed from Gladstone, either by road or rail or by little ships going south. But with our railway, we're going to build it to have freight trains that go at 100k an hour. We can get freight from Gladstone down to Sydney coming in the back way 4 days quicker than if the boat went on, and Melbourne 7 days quicker than if the boat went on, and the same going the other way back with exports. The whole thing is based on containers, and my forecast is, and I won't live to see it, Gladstone will become the Rotterdam of Australia in terms of how this happens. So we're looking at a freight revolution. We're also looking at setting up little industries all the way from Gladstone to Melbourne when this is done, in all small communities, value-adding whatever they produce there to encourage the growth of those communities. Governments all my life have been saying we're going to revolutionise the bush. Well, I want them to give low-interest loans to people who can start businesses out there, and people can leave the cities and come out to a place like Gundawindi and get a house twice the size for half the price with no pollution all around them and have a good life. And so this thing's quite dramatic, David.
No, it all sounds very positive. You've known Anthony Albanese for many years. He's an infrastructure guy, often, you know, reminds us that he was Minister for Infrastructure for a long time. He copped some flack, obviously from the Nats and in the bush generally for calling a halt to inland rail at Parkes. But do you think he's genuinely keen on your idea here? I mean, give us a sense of how likely you think it is that Anthony Albanese will see this through.
I've known Anthony Albanese for 25 years. Like all of them, he's a politician. They make mistakes sometimes. Sometimes they do things they shouldn't do. But I have a level of trust. We're not close friends, but I have a level of trust that I think that he's aware that having made the decision he did to stop it at Parkes, he must allow alternatives for this to happen. And the whole thing went way beyond just this railway not being completed. The people in the bush believe they've been shortchanged for investment since the beginning of time. We've got a nation in which 80% of the population is in the capital cities and the surrounds of the capital cities, and only 20% left. And the bush has missed out. There's no two ways about it. Not just under Albany, even every National Party, Country Party government still didn't look after the bush because they know the votes are in the cities. And so we've got a situation where this has just brought to a head the long-standing feeling in the bush that they've been left behind and that they're a good place to live, a hell of a lot better place to live than wound up in a capital city.
Let's talk a bit about your role over the many years, Everald, on this issue and other issues. I mean, let's start with Anthony Albanese. You mentioned that you've got some trust for him. How does he compare to the other, 14 prime ministers that you've dealt with?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, it would be politically smart for me right now, seeing I want Albo to cooperate with me, to say that Albo's number one. I'm almost inclined, you know, just to say that. But look, over the years, I first went to see Robert Menzies when I was at age 26. I'd been appointed 2 years earlier to build St Andrew's Hospital for the Presbyterian Church, of which I'm an active member, and I raised the money and built the first two sections. And when they started at age 24, age 26, we needed some government money, and because we were a Presbyterian hospital, I went to Canberra to see Bob Menzies, who was a Presbyterian. Now, Bob was wise enough, Sir Robert, not to give us money because we're Presbyterians, but he recognised Brisbane needs another public hospital. Now, Menzies was a bloke who, he looked like the Prime Minister, he acted like the Prime Minister, superbly dressed. When he walked into the room, he sort of commanded the room.
Was he intimidating? Was he intimidating?
Well, he could be if you took him that way, but I mean, I think if you took into account his personality, I mean, he was an overpowering person. I mean, so was Gough Whitlam. I mean, Gough Whitlam was he was one of the, probably the greatest visionary of my lifetime was Gough Whitlam. There's no two ways about that, except he didn't have the ability to put his visions into practice, but as a visionary, you know, he was. But, I mean, Menzies certainly, he was Prime Minister for 19-odd years. Nobody's ever going to alter that. And it was a time of relative prosperity for Australia. So you'd have to put him somewhere near the top. It's controversial for me to say it, but I developed a very good working relationship with Julia Gillard when she was Prime Minister in most difficult circumstances, where she had to rely on five independents.
Yeah.
And I was Chairman of National Seniors Australia at the time. And I found when I went to her, I could get in, I would get a good hearing, and I would get a decision. I mightn't like the decision, but I got one. And I think she was extraordinary. I think her misogyny speech, and I was at Parliament the day it happened, was one of the greatest speeches ever made in the Australian Parliament. Having said that, she lost the confidence of a party and the confidence of the voters. But if you wanted to say to me, who would I like to give number one to, it would be Julia Gillard.
So that's so interesting. That's so interesting. And, of course, she's the only woman on that list of the 15 PMs you've dealt with. I mean, what does that tell you, Elvira?
Well, she also had two leaders of the opposition. She had to fight Tony Abbott and Kevin Rudd at the same time. Nobody else has done that. But she passed more legislation in her 2.5 years than any other Prime Minister in Australian history. So I got on well with Bob Hawke. He was an absolute larrikin, old Bob.
And in terms of the other prime ministers, you mentioned Gough Whitlam there, and look, only there for a short time by comparison. But what did you call him?
A great visionary. You know, he had a marvellous vision of Australia. Gough Whitlam. I was in the House when he got the legislation through to have equal pay for women. You know, equal pay for equal work. And the opposition and the Billy Snedden, I think it was, are hotly opposed to saying if you pay women the same as you pay men, you know, the country's going to go bankrupt. Yeah. And they fought him, and he got it through. And then the opposition changed tack, and they then said, well, it's true, but let's admit women never do the same quality work as men. Women can't do it. And even to this day, as you know, we still don't have equality of wages. But Gough Whitlam put his soul right into that, and I think it was one of the great pieces of Australian legislation. And an example of what a visionary can do, and said, it's just a pity that for instance, Gough Whitlam didn't have Paul Keating running the books of the show when he was Prime Minister, because Paul Keating, for an uneducated bloke, didn't go to university, had one of the best brains I've ever come across. He also had a delightful ability to annoy people and have the most crushing one-liners he could trot out in Parliament than ever I've heard. But if he and Whitlam had been together, we would have had a different show.
Interesting, interesting. Who is the most difficult Prime Minister to work with?
That's a... Well, put it this way, Billy McMahon was without doubt the weakest and poorest Prime Minister of my time. So it was difficult in the sense that Billy didn't really know what you were talking about. I suppose it's not easy to sort of say, well, who was the most difficult? Every one of them had good things and every one of them had... had bad things about them.
And the thing is, and you touched on it earlier, the political environment has changed so much over those many years. I mean, you would have witnessed enormous change. Politicians, prime ministers with more minders around them, more scrutiny on the decisions they're making, a 24/7 media cycle. I mean, ultimately, it does still come down to the willingness to make the right decision for the nation. But what have been the biggest changes you've noticed, for better or worse, over those years dealing with prime ministers?
Well, when I first experienced, politics, it was in an age when people tended to go into parliament when they were had a successful career behind them, whether it was in business or the law or accounting or farming or something or other, and they wanted to go in with a sense of serving the nation. And you even had a bloke like Joe Bjelke Petersen who wouldn't join the superannuation fund because he said, he's supposed to be there serving the country, and he never ever took superannuation. So people had a sense of, I'm here to serve the country. Now it's moved, and it's all about power in a way that power wasn't exercised back. Back then, of course, the 24/7 newspaper makes power, incredible. But right now, everything that happens in Parliament is fundamentally about, have we got power, have we not got power? And I remember one old Polly saying to me, don't go into Parliament ever, as an MP, unless you got the chequebook. If you haven't got the chequebook, it's no good turning up. Sitting in opposition is the greatest waste of time ever had. So there is now a thing in which power dominates. And I remember having a scotch with John Howard one night at the Lodge, where he said to me, when I get up at question time, he said, people think the people in front of me are my enemies, the opposition, he said. He said, half the people behind me want my job, Everett. He said, I've got to spend time every day making sure that I am the Prime Minister tomorrow. And that's how power influences the whole show, doesn't it?
It certainly does, Everett. So good to talk to you. And I could keep talking to you about Prime Ministers for hours. But look, we will catch up again, I'm sure. As you've said, you're going to see this Inland Rail project done in your lifetime. So it'll be good to check in with you again and see where this goes from here. But look, thanks so much for giving us an update Inland Rail, but your recollections on the many dealings with Prime Ministers over the years.
Well, if we go to schedule, I'll be 101 years old when this is finished. Now, I'm sure you'll still be running the ABC at that time, so we'll talk again.
I look forward to it. Everett Compton, thank you. We'll have more on all that's been going on this week on Insiders on Sunday morning. Hope you can join us then on ABC TV. And PK will be back in the podcast feed on Monday. Bye for now.
You're making us all feel very excited about being here.